Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, May 14, 2026. On the front page of the News Gazette is a photo with headline Smile of Success and the caption, Iroquois West's Audrey Griffin celebrates after clearing the bar at 5 foot 1 and 3/4 inches on the high jump during Wednesday afternoon's Class 1A Salt Forks track and field sectional meet in Kaplan. She qualified for next week's state meet on the Eastern Illinois campus in Charleston. Jim Dye's opinion column is on the front page. Resolution, more appropriate ways to thank U of I donor exist. Calling it wrong to rename Memorial Stadium after a generous donor, a state legislator from Woodstock has filed a resolution in the Illinois House seeking to drop Larry Gee's last name from the 100-plus-year-old landmark. There are other more appropriate ways for the university to acknowledge such a generous gift and still keep what Memorial Stadium was originally built to stand for, said Republican State Representative Steve Reek. Reek's resolution, House Resolution 0895, was introduced Wednesday and so far has attracted 11 co-sponsors. He characterized the measure as a request to University of Illinois President Tim Killeen, U of I trustees, Athletic Director Josh Whitman, and the Gee's family. The Gee's name was added to the stadium last fall to recognize a $100 million donation to Larry and Beth Gee's. Gee's made the donation in honor of his U.S. Army veteran father. Prior to that gift, the 1988 graduate pledged $150 million to the U of I's business school, now called the Gee's College of Business. Gee's is a fabulously successful businessman who has earned billionaire status. He and Madison Industries, the business Gee's oversees, recently were profiled in Forbes magazine. Reek saluted the Gee's generosity, but urged U of I officials to find another way to demonstrate their gratitude. That does not appear likely at this time. In response, U of I Athletics reissued a previous statement on the name change that read, "We acknowledge the highly personal connection that many have to our football stadium. As we made clear in the communication surrounding the original announcement, the university has the utmost respect and appreciation for the history and purpose of our stadium, feelings shared by Illinois alumnus Larry Gee's, who has chosen to invest in protecting and amplifying the stadium's proud legacy for generations to come. We are grateful for his remarkable generosity and commitment to advancing the stadium's mission while also ensuring that the Memorial Stadium name remains central to the building's identity." Reek said he would have preferred not to draw public attention to the issue, but he said he spoke to Killeen and U of I trustees earlier this year and found they had no appetite to make a change. He said U of I officials contacted him about the resolution, and they agreed to hold a teleconference to discuss the issue. A U of I graduate who practices law in McHenry County, Reek said he has visited the Illini's football stadium home many times over the years, but said he somehow missed the announcement about the name change. His attention was drawn to it when he read a lengthy history of the stadium published in the Illinois State Historical Society's magazine, and was reminded that, in the words of a former U of I president, David Kinley, it is a memorial to those of the university who died in World War I. Reek's resolution noted that the names of 189 University of Illinois World War I fallen were inscribed onto the 200 columns that supported, mark, and define the structure of the stadium. Since then, the stadium's dedication has been extended to those who died in World War II and honors the 948 alumni, students, faculty, and staff who were killed in our nation's wars and conflicts since 1918. Just as Gee's cited the memory of his soldier father, Reek cited the World War I death of his great-uncle, Bert Whitehurst. Mr. Whitehurst, who was a brother to Reek's grandmother, was killed 3 days before the war ended. He said he has no problem with the U of I changing the name to the former Assembly Hall to State Farm Center, but objects to the name change of a war memorial. "I haven't talked to anyone who thinks this is a good idea," he said. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. There's a photo in the column with the caption, Maki Ostrander works on a peony arrangement. To complement this weekend's popular picnic with the peonies at Allerton Park, Illinois Prairie Chapter of Ikonobo Ikebana is hosting its party with peonies at the mansion. Chapter members will have peony-inspired Ikebana arrangements on display 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday and 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Sunday. At noon Sunday, also free of charge, Chapter President Jean Holley will hold a grand Ikebana demonstration in the mansion's library. She's happy to spill the beans about her unique floral skills in what she said will be a sophisticated journey from the very traditional to very modern. American education, losing our literacy. U.S. kids reportedly in reading recession, marked by declining test scores, some districts look to phonics for a fix. Before every important test, teacher Nancy Ramos dims the lights, turns on a disco ball, and blasts music from her playlist. Her sixth graders dance together as a pre-celebration to boost their confidence, then take their exam. Lately, there's been a lot to celebrate in elementary schools in Modesto. Both reading and math scores have increased consistently over the past several years. But across the country, results are gloomier. Researchers warn that the U.S. is experiencing a reading recession, a slide predating the pandemic's disruptions in schooling. Scholars at Harvard, Stanford, and Dartmouth analyzed state test scores from 3rd to 8th grade for over 5,000 school districts in 38 states, allowing comparisons across school districts and states in a national education scorecard. What they found was sobering. Only 5 states plus the District of Columbia had meaningful growth in reading test scores from 2022 to 2025. Nationally, students remain nearly half a grade level behind pre-pandemic reading scores and only slightly better in math. While schools have focused on catching kids up since the COVID-19 pandemic upended education, reading test scores have been falling since 2013 for 8th graders and 2015 for 4th graders, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. The pandemic was the mudslide that had followed 7 years of steady erosion in achievement, said Thomas Kane, a Harvard professor who helped create the educational scorecard. Still, some states and school districts are making progress, largely by shifting toward phonics-based instruction and providing extra support for struggling readers. The picture is also brighter in math. Almost every state in analysis saw improvement in math test scores from 2022 to 2025. Student absenteeism also declined in most states. In more than 400 U.S. school districts, including Modesto, reading or math group outpaced demographically similar districts in the same state. A shift toward phonics. Researchers are still debating the reading recession causes. One possible factor, researchers say, is the rise of social media on smartphones and corresponding declines in kids' recreational reading. States have also backed off on strict consequences for schools whose students fail to make progress on standardized tests, Kane said. But the states that improved reading scores, notably Louisiana, Maryland, Tennessee, and Kentucky, and Indiana, all had one thing in common. They ordered schools to teach with a phonics-based approach known as the science of reading. For years, schools taught reading using approaches that de-emphasized phonics and encouraged strategies such as guessing words based on context clues. As reading scores tumbled over the past decade, parents, scholars, and literacy advocates pushed for teaching methods that align with decades of research about how kids learn to read, largely by sounding out words. Along with reforming teaching methods, states have also required schools to screen for learning disabilities, such as dyslexia, and hires coaches to help teachers improve their reading instruction. She said the science of reading reforms did not guarantee success. Some states, including Florida, Arizona, and Nebraska, changed parts of their reading instruction, but still saw test scores fall. In Modesto, reading instruction was revamped during the pandemic and math a couple years earlier. The district created a new department to help students who are still learning English. Schools also ramped up teacher training, paying educators $5,000 to complete an extensive science of reading program called Letters, or Language Essentials for Teachers of Reading and Spelling. Modesto's test scores grew enough to represent an extra 18 weeks of learning in math and 13 weeks in reading. Nevertheless, the district still has a way to go. Overall scores remain far below grade level. A key to Detroit's success. A focus on reading has also improved scores in Detroit, but so have efforts to get kids in school more consistently. For years, the large urban district struggled with deplorable school conditions, leading to a 2016 lawsuit in which students argued they'd been denied the right to read. This lawsuit ended in a settlement of over $94 million, money that helped move the needle. While the district is still far below the national average, student test scores have grown faster than in similar urban districts in Michigan. It took a lot to rebuild systems and how kids are learning at higher levels, but I'm still not satisfied, and I think that's the next challenge, continuing to motivate, inspire, and change things, said Detroit Superintendent Nikolai Vitti. The money has helped Munger Elementary Middle School, located in a largely Latino neighborhood in Detroit, to employ 18 educators who give kids extra support in small groups. An attendance agent also makes calls to the homes of absent students, even showing up at their doors. Just a few years ago, says first grade teacher Samantha Chaffoni, it was normal for about 7 or 8 kids to be absent from her class every day. Now it's only usually 1 or 2. It allows us to be better educators, to see kids consistently in the seat instead of once or twice a week, said Chaffoni. It makes such a difference. How county clerks are combating misinformation. Trust in U.S. elections is eroding. Between skepticism about redistricting, fear about immigration agents at the polls, and unproven claims about widespread election fraud, Americans are losing confidence in the accuracy and security of their elections. But many local election authorities say their effort to address misinformation and reassure voters is beginning to turn the tide as they've seen less voter concern about election security. Voter confidence in accurate vote counts dropped 17% across party lines in about a year, according to 2 nationwide polls from the Center for Transport and Trusted Elections at the University of California, San Diego. One poll was conducted just after the 2024 presidential election, the other in late 2025, in collaboration with UCSD's Yankelevich Center for Social Science Research. Voters had different reasons for why they are skeptical about the midterms, and those reasons broke across party lines, with more Republicans naming redistricting as a concern and Democrats more worried about the presence of immigration agents at the polls. Although 60% of respondents indicated they did have confidence in the midterms, the survey paints a bleak picture ahead of this fall, and it was followed by headlines about the Supreme Court's ruling weakening a key racial redistricting provision in the Voting Rights Act, the Department of Justice suing states for access to voter records, and a report finding a Trump appointee encouraged the DOJ raid of election offices in Fulton County, Georgia. This is all on the heels of President Donald Trump's repeated but disproven claims of widespread voter fraud and falsified 2020 election results. Now he's staffed his federal administration with officials who echoed his claims in 2020 and refused to walk them back, doubling down in some cases. For one, Kash Patel, the embattled director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, is overseeing the investigation that led to the Fulton County raid and a subpoena of Maricopa County, Arizona records. Just last week, the administration demanded names of election officials who worked in the county during the 2020 elections. Much like Pam Bondi, the former director of the Justice Department, Patel would not state that Joe Biden won the 2020 election in his confirmation hearing. The Trump administration's efforts to establish a narrative of fraud, lies, and vote stealing during Biden's presidency are not for nothing, as the UCSD poll shows Americans of both parties have begun to doubt if they can trust upcoming elections. It makes for a tense environment as the country rockets towards the 2026 midterms and as rumors swirl around potential 2028 presidential nominees. But across the country and within Illinois, election authorities of both parties say American elections are and will stay fair and secure. While county clerks report they have an impact on their local constituencies, the disparate nature of U.S. elections, while widely considered a strength, make communicating to a broader audience a great challenge. Authority over administering elections by federal law is given to the states. In Illinois, elections are administered either by the 102 county clerks or the 6 municipal election commissions. The Illinois State Board of Elections works with these local election authorities in an advisory capacity. Every state has differing laws on election administration, and each Illinois county clerk conducts their elections a little differently. The needs and wishes of the voting population of Chicago and suburban Cook County, for example, are much different than those of Tazewell or Sangamon County. The environment makes things complicated, but local authority is part of the strength of Illinois elections, according to Republican Tazewell County Clerk John Ackerman. Individuals have the ability to go in and see how their elections are being handled in their jurisdiction, Ackerman said. There isn't some appointed bureaucrat that is running this operation. It's an individual they have a direct impact of putting into office. That's something that should give them more faith if they don't like the way things aren't being done. Capital News Illinois spoke with county clerks from across the state to find out more about what they do to administer a secure election and maintain voter confidence. Ackerman said many sources track deteriorating trust in elections back to 2020, but he believes it really started in 2016, the same year foreign hackers breached election databases in Illinois and Arizona. The hackers were able to steal some voters' information that was already publicly available. But while they accessed the voter roll, they could not access any tabulators, machines that scan each ballot and count the votes, because they are not connected to outside internet and can't be hacked. Still, claims of election fraud dominated the 2016 campaign trail, with Trump frequently deriding a system he called rigged. Post-election Green Party candidate Jill Stein launched a recount effort for the presidential race, backed by losing Democrat Hillary Clinton, as Trump's shock election to the presidency shook voter confidence for some. What we saw in 2016 at the federal level were social media campaigns that were aimed at all, not just one particular voting group, said Matt Dietrich, public information officer at the Illinois State Board of Elections. They were aimed at everyone, and they were basically there to sow discord among voters to create conflict. Teacher of the Week, a supportive squad, Christabel Bortz, Carlos Rodriguez, and Alex Zarco, second grade, International Prep Academy, Champaign. 2 years ago, Christabel Bortz, Carlos Rodriguez, and Alex Zarco all began teaching second grade at International Prep Academy along with Sherry Gittens. This year, Gittens took time away from school on maternity leave, and she took notice of how caring and supportive her grade-level partners were when she was gone and also when she returned. Their kindness, teamwork, and genuine care made a challenging time much more manageable, and their support reflects the true spirit of what it means to be an exceptional educator and colleague, Gittens said. In addition, they are amazing educators. They come to school every day and give 110% to their students. They are passionate about their students' success and pour into them each and every day. Alex Zarco, I became a teacher because when I began working as a teaching assistant at IPA, I quickly realized how much I enjoyed working with students. I also saw in myself and many of the children I worked with. When I started school in Champaign, I spoke no English at all, although I learned quickly, balancing both a new language and academic content was challenging. Many of our students today are learning English as a second or even third language and face similar experiences. I feel a strong connection to those students and strive to encourage and support them the same way my teacher supported me when I was young. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is, one of my favorite lessons is teaching about life cycles. Students really enjoy these lessons because it taps into their natural curiosity about growth, change, and the world around them. I keep students engaged by, I make an effort to learn about my students' interests and incorporate those interests into the classroom environment. For example, my co-worker, Mr. Rodriguez, and I discovered that many of our students love Pokemon cards. We use them as incentives to encourage hard work, motivation, and positive classroom behavior. Something else I'm passionate about is, I'm passionate about coaching soccer. I coach both boys and girls soccer at Central High School and still enjoy playing recreationally with my brothers whenever I can. My son is growing up surrounded by soccer and already loves the game as well. Playing it with him is one of my favorite things to do. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was, my favorite teacher was my second grade teacher, Olga Halpern. She believed in me in a way that had a lasting impact on my academic journey and eventually came more like family to me. Today I am fortunate to work alongside her at IPA, where she serves as our second grade team coach. Not many people get to say that their second grade teacher later became their coworker. If I weren't a teacher, I would be. If I were not a teacher, I think I would have been really fun to be a professional soccer player. Soccer was a huge part of my life growing up, and I was fortunate to receive soccer scholarships that helped me attend college. Without those opportunities, becoming a first-generation college graduate may not have been possible. Christabel Bortz, I became a teacher because I wanted to work with students who needed someone to love them and be there for them. My goal as a teacher is to show students that they are loved and can be successful. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is writing detailed sentences. I teach it through writing instructions on how to build s'mores. The students have to write me instructions on how to make a s'more. I then build the s'more based on their writing and show them why detail is important when writing sentences. I keep students engaged by giving them brain breaks throughout the day and by staying positive. Something else I'm passionate about is reading. I love to sit by the pool or just outside in the summer and read. My favorite genre is fiction. My favorite teacher was Mrs. Friendly. She taught at Judah Christian School in second grade. She taught me how to love books, and I am forever grateful to her for teaching me how easy reading was and how many adventures I could have through a book. If I weren't a teacher, I would be a veterinarian. Carlos Rodriguez, I became a teacher because it has always been a lifelong passion of mine. It also provides me with an opportunity to influence the youth in a more multicultural lens. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is ancient Greek civilization and mythology. I keep students engaged by connecting lessons with my students, keeping a high energy, and embracing the chaos that comes each day. Something else I'm passionate about is soccer in our community. My favorite teacher and subject to teach in school was my high school math teacher, Mr. Bechtel. He's had a huge influence on how I am as a teacher. 45 years of community, that's the headline alongside a picture that says, celebrating a recent 45th anniversary, the Greater Champaign County AmBucks chapter, chartered in 1981 with 25 members, one of whom, Keith Jameson, remains. Over the years, the group has provided to area families more than 600 AmTrikes, therapeutic tricycles designed for those unable to ride a two-wheeled bicycle. The club has also awarded scholarships to Parkland College therapy students, supported other groups whose mission is to help people with disabilities, and helped community events at East Urbana's AmBucks Park. Says Jameson, our membership is a great slice of the community, and the glue that holds us together is the work and projects we do that touch and benefit our community. Champaign County Community Coalition. Law enforcement leaders discuss recent and ongoing cases. Updates provided by local law enforcement agencies at May's Champaign County Community Coalition meeting included multiple recent violent incidents, some of which have yet to lead to an arrest. Champaign County Sheriff Dustin Huerman said that around 2 a.m. on April 16th, deputies responded to the Northwood Estates Mobile Home Park for a report of a shooting. They learned that a woman had received a graze wound from a projectile that entered her residence, which Huerman said he believed had an entry point relatively close to the bed where she was sleeping. The victim was transported to a hospital. Deputies found several spent shell casings near the residence and more damage to the outside of the building, suggesting several shots had been fired. Heumann said this is still an active investigation. On May 7th at around 8 p.m., deputies responded to the emergency room at Carl Foundation Hospital, Urbana. A patient there had a single gunshot wound to his left leg. He reported having heard gunshots near Perkins Road and Brownfield Road in Urbana Township and said that he ran to his friend's house before noticing he'd been shot in the leg, after which he called an Uber to take him to the hospital. Metcad didn't receive any calls about shots fired in that area, and Heumann said the investigation suggests that the victim accidentally discharged a firearm and inflicted the wound on himself. Heumann said that included those two. The sheriff's office had handled three shooting incidents thus far this year. The third involved property damage, but no injuries. Champaign Police Lieutenant Catherine Thompson gave a description of the four districts her department divides Champaign into and explained that she specifically works in the North District. CPD has responded to two notable incidents in the last couple of weeks, she said, one of which was the May 1st shooting homicide of 33-year-old Aaron Sibley of Champaign. Charles Haynes, 21, of Kankakee, has been arrested and charged in that incident. Thompson also reported that on May 9th at around 5:13 p.m., police responded to the 1000 block of Crescent Drive for a report of a stabbing. They located a 37-year-old man suffering from multiple stab wounds. He was transported to a hospital where he is still undergoing treatment. Further investigation revealed that the stabbing itself occurred on the 2600 block of West Springfield, and the victim fled over to Crescent while seeking assistance. Thompson said no arrests have been made and that Champaign Police urge anyone with information to contact the Department of Crime Stoppers. Urbana Deputy Chief Zachary Michalik reported that Urbana Police have responded to two shootings in recent weeks, but that neither involved any reported injuries. Overall, he said that violent crime is down 9% and total crime is down 13% in Urbana so far this year. University of Illinois Police Lieutenant Jason Bradley reported a recent incident when an officer was able to reverse an overdose using Narcan. He also reminded the coalition that his department is preparing for graduation this weekend when around 11,000 students are expected to celebrate earning their degrees. $850,000 grant to help fund further improvements to downtown. Thanks to the efforts of Mayor Bill Ingold and other city officials, Honorary James Kingston Way is getting even more upgrades. Ingold announced during this week's Paxton City Council meeting that the city has been awarded an $850,000 federal grant to replace the light pole sidewalks, street curbs, and gutters in the 100 block of South Market Street, part of the downtown corridor named in honor of its late predecessor, Jim Kingston, and to build curb bump outs at the northeast and south northwest corners of the intersection of Market and Center Streets. The work, expected to be completed in 2027, is the second phase of the city's downtown streetscape improvement project. The $1.1 million first phase was completed in 2022, using money left over from the city's revolving loan fund that Kingston helped establish. As soon as the first phase was finished, the city set out to secure state or federal grants to help fund further streetscape improvements, including sidewalk and light pole replacement in the 100 and 200 blocks of South Market and 200 block of North Market, but with no immediate success. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, May 14th, 2026. Please stay tuned for Part 2.